Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 2450. So glad to have the great Clifton Duncan back with me. I think this is the third time you've been on. And the very first time you were on, I discovered something incredible about you partway through the conversation. But we'll start off by saying, and you can fill in the blanks here in a minute, but Clifton, let's say, was very, very much up and coming, beyond up and coming, as a Broadway actor, as a television actor, getting outstanding reviews. But the feature about him that was so interesting was that I realized partway through our first conversation that I had seen him a couple of times on Broadway, never realizing, because how could I, that someday our paths would cross. And I told my kids, and I said, "You remember this guy from this play?" They all said, "Of course." They all remembered you. So anyway, Clifton Duncan, I know in a way, Clifton, it's probably irritating to have to tell the story over and over, but we are introducing you in some cases to a whole new group of people. So talk about, if you wouldn't mind, just for a minute, what happened to your acting career. I hate to even bring it up.
Well, 1 minute exactly, that's a challenge.
But, well, however long you want is fine with me.
But just a quick fact check, though. This is only the second time I've been on your show.
Oh, no, that's not true. It's the third, because the second time you were on with Hawk Jensen talking about the
documentary. Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's true. It's very true.
Yeah.
But yeah, so my name is Clifton Duncan. I'm what used to be known as a classically trained actor. I went to New York University, their graduate acting program, got my MFA from the fancy acting school. And over the next almost decade or so, I built up a resume working all around the country on America's Best Stages. Finally, my representatives at the time begged me to stay in New York, and eventually I did. I ended up landing in some great critically acclaimed shows off Broadway, and then I landed on Broadway in a show called The Play That Goes Wrong, which is a beloved British comedy, which Tom Woods probably knows more about than I do, and I was in the damn thing. I began to garner some award recognition. I was appearing on TV with guys like Jimmy Smits and Scott Bakula, which is pretty cool. Then 2020 happened. And at first, for about the first 3 months, I was totally on board. I was in what I call the COVIDian cult and stocking up on goods and supplies. And you never saw me fighting grandma for toilet paper at the local bodega, for instance. By about April, I began to say something isn't right and something is weird. And why aren't more people asking questions about this? I ended up fleeing to Atlanta, Georgia, where that totally blew my mind, or just took the wool away from my eyes, because while everyone was locked down in New York, in Atlanta, it was pretty much like, it was like night and day. And a few months after that, the entertainment industry just went full bore into COVIDianism, and they instituted industry-wide vaccine mandates. I was beginning to get availability checks from different theaters. They were asking, you know, do you plan on, or are you already vaccinated against COVID? And I'd already recovered from the disease. So I was like, well, why should I have to take this thing, which is like rush through, yada, yada, yada. You know, we don't have to go down that rabbit hole. But essentially, you can sort of guess what happened. Got dropped, couldn't get a job anywhere. So I went from being a star on the rise to waiting tables at age 40 in Atlanta, Georgia. I often joke that, you know, typically what you do is that you wait tables and then you make it. But I made it and then I went to waiting tables. So my life makes no sense. So here we are today. I've become an accidental influencer. I've built up a bit of a following and somewhat of a platform by speaking my mind. And we'll see what the future holds now. I don't know what it is, but we're here now. So maybe that was a good summation of my story, as it were.
Well, we're going to talk about something a little later that fills me with hope. Because I have said multiple times, with you not around, that I hate living in a world in which Clifton Duncan can't follow his passion. You know, I detest this world for that reason. So we're going to see what can be done about that. But let's talk about, you have a Substack to which I subscribe, by the way. And I don't mean subscribe, you know, I send you a few bucks. I don't just read the articles. And
well, thank you.
Your stuff, your insights into the theater are obviously born out of personal observation and careful study of trends. And you have a series of two pieces on the fate of American theater at the moment that has a lot to do with COVID, but not exclusively. There are other aspects of theater and the kind of people who populate American theater that are combining to tank the theater. And what's interesting to, so I want to talk about what's going on in American theater, but also what's interesting is you specifically point out that this is not a question of all forms of in-person entertainment are all suffering, because they're not. There's something about the theater in particular that seems to be driving its own demise. So that's a huge question to start off with, but why don't we narrow it a bit by talking specifically about Broadway? If I go to Broadway right now, a superficial observer might look around and say, hey, there are a lot of shows running. There are a lot of performances. I go in there and, you know, it looks to the average person like there are a lot of people in attendance. So what's the problem?
Well, you know, the issue was multi-pronged, but, you know, Broadway in the 2018 and 2019 seasons hit record box office highs. It has not recovered from those record-breaking highs. It has not returned to any kind of median level of success that it once achieved. And the articles were coming fast and furious just a few months ago. I mean, even right-wing outlets like The Federalist were reporting on the demise and collapse of the American theater. And as you pointed out, this demise has not hit professional sports or combat sports or even fake combat sports like pro wrestling, which are still thriving. It's specifically the performing arts in cities like New York, which are struggling to keep audiences. And my argument is that part of it was the COVIDian madness, and part of it is colloquially is now known as wokeness. I think it's a bit played out, but this sort of far left, quote unquote, progressive groupthink has destroyed American theater by its people have become deranged by politics. But, you know, I'm sure you and your listeners are very aware, you know, the sort of left-wing hubris. I've sort of built that series around this idea of hubris and sort of an Aristotelian tragedy in the sense that hubris is a classic tragic flaw in heroes, which brings them down, brings upon nemesis. And I just don't foresee, you know, people tell me this, the pendulum will swing back, but I don't see how it will between the politics, which inform the programming, the sort of shows that get programmed and put on Broadway. I think, you know, there was an announcement recently that there's a show called, there's two of them. One, it's like Putin the Musical or something like that. And you know, an exploration of his rise to power. Who, that's going to put butts in seats. Who doesn't want to see that?
Especially when it's the CIA version, of course.
Well, you know, it's just, it's fascinating. There's another one called, you know, My Big Gay Queer, something or other. And I feel torn about it because, you know, the theater is classically a home for outcasts and people who are kind of on the margins, you know what I mean? Those weird theater kids in your high school turn out to be the next stars, directors, writers, producers of the next generation. And for me, at least, it was a home. I was a shy, kind of introverted military brat, but also kind of a class clown and a weirdo. And finally, I found a sort of home among other weirdos and found that I had an aptitude for acting. But around 2014, 2015, I began to feel like ideologically I was not quite, I didn't quite belong. And Trump's election really accelerated that in a huge way. I mean, people just lost their minds. It was unbelievable. And then 2020, when everything shut down, there was a massive, massive cultural shift. I first got wind of it when the Actors Equity Association, which is the union for stage actors and stage managers, they sent out this email about in March 2021, maybe it was 2020, I forget which year, but they basically said that the old adage that the show must go on, which is like what theater people swore by, right? It's, you know, you're tough, you've got strength and stamina, you know, you're not doing it for the money, you're doing it for the love, and every person in that audience deserves the 100%, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you might be sick, you might be tired or whatever, but you're going to show up and you're going to give your all because those people out there have paid their time and money and they deserve it. But Actors Equity sent out this email that said that we now realize that the phrase, the show must go on, is both out of date or something like that, and unjust, meaning racist. And I was like,
I remember being
on.
Shocked at this.
Well, I was like, hold on a second. And then, you know, the whole George Floyd thing happened and these sweeping changes. I mean, it struck the theater like a lightning bolt. And to be fair, you know, you're talking about an industry which is perpetually left wing, you know, run by people who are very compassionate and very empathetic and very open emotionally. That's why they're in the theater. You know, but they watch the news and they believe everything the news tells them. And, you know, we were all outraged when we saw that initial footage of George Floyd. But I learned by that point to be very skeptical whenever there's a news story of a black man meeting an unfortunate end with the police involved. Let's say it that way. But the industry just really, really went full on into anti-racism, the Robin DiAngelo, the Ibram X. Kendi kind of cultism. And it was between that and how the industry responded to COVID that really made me speak up. I had an anonymous account where I spoke my true opinions, but also like a regular account where I just was like, hey guys, come and see me in my show, which no one cared about, which I was fine with. But once things really began, I became so concerned with how quickly things were popping off that I just began to really say what was on my mind. And I knew some of the right people, got on some good shows like Trigonometry, for instance, and Tim Pool's show. And things just kind of took off from there. But then the vaccine mandates came down and it was like, you know, I already had this thing. I'm not taking this new drug. You can take it. I don't care. Just don't force me to take it. And that was pretty much it. I mean, as we all know, there was just a sort of weird religious dogmatic zeal surrounding these vaccines, which is weird because some prominent Democrats, including our current president and vice president, were very much like, I'm not taking that Trump vaccine. But then as soon as Biden was in office, it was like, you better take this vaccine or you're a murderer. So it was so obvious that it was far more political and partisan than it had anything to do with actual scientific or medical merit. And I was one of the only people in the entire theater industry, which, you know, who was saying like, we shouldn't be doing this. And now I've been purged as a result, but it's given me permission to actually befriend intelligent people. So that's one silver lining.
Yeah, really, really. I mean, who is that guy from Mumford & Sons who all he said was, I think Andy Ngo's book is kind of interesting. That's all he said. And he had to be that you're not allowed to think that book is interesting. I mean, what kind of, I mean, really, yeah. These are psychotic people. These are not normal people.
Yeah, well, it was Winston Marshall.
Yeah.
Who's become a friend of mine. And, you know, it's, there's a coalition of people now that's gathering of accomplished artists who are kind of sick of this stuff and trying to do something about it. But what's really sad, and to go back to your original question about, you know, what the real problem is, it's just, it's this really sort of absurd groupthink where you can't say anything else. And what's especially cruel in the entertainment industry, and, you know, and I say, if you think Hollywood is woke, the theater is about 10 times more concentrated. It's worse. And the issue is that the industry is heavily built on relationships and reputation, R&R. And nobody wants to be considered difficult. Nobody wants to be the outlier. Everyone wants to get hired again because you don't know what when your next job is going to be there. So especially for actors, there's always 100 people that, you know, want to take your place. So
yeah,
you don't want to get out of step with the sort of cultural zeitgeist. So there was all this pressure not to say anything. And I keep getting messages from people who are like, yeah, you're right, you know, privately. But publicly, they'll say nothing because they don't want to jeopardize their careers. Because
I wondered if some of it was the uniquely precarious life of the actor, if that was behind some of the lack of courage as compared to maybe in other professions.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons that these measures were so egregious is that if you say no to a role or if you say no to anything, you know, there's going to be, I mean, you're imminently replaceable, you know, unless you're a mega star. And by the way, you know, if you're in the union, you know, if you work consecutive weeks, the more you work, the more you're eligible for health insurance. So what they did was during what they were calling the worst pandemic of the century or in a century, they were depriving their own members of the ability to get health insurance by depriving them of the opportunity to work. Yeah. It was so disgusting. But even more disgusting was the fact that just nobody else said anything. Just nobody said anything. And that to me, when people say the pendulum will swing back, I say, no, you can't swing back from this because this is an industry that is full of people who are either cowardly, they're conformist, or they're liars. A lot of people got like just fake vax cards. So, you know, from depending on what your point of view is, there's no scruples there. But this is an industry that just doesn't care about its own survival. It has no sense of self-defense. It has no sense of its own self-worth. Because part of the reason that I became so furious is that I was looking around the country at people, gym owners, salon owners, barbers, restaurateurs, who were fighting their own governments tooth and nail to stay open and to feed their employees and to feed their families. Why is it that these people stood up for their right to be essential, basically, for their right to work, but yet these pretentious, preening progressives said, no, we're going to sit back and demand the government pay us not to work, which, by the way, they probably weren't working anyway. Most people are not employed anyway. You know what I mean?
Right,
so
right.
It was so, the sort of classism of the whole affair really, really bothered me, even though I may not sound like it. I didn't come from privilege. I come from a pretty humble background. And, my mom was in the army, met a lot of great sort of blue collar working class people in Virginia and around the country, really. And to see these sort of pretentious theater artists, so to speak, I can't really call them artists because they decided that they were less essential than McDonald's and liquor stores. But to see them thumb their noses at people who just want to work was just beyond the pale for me. And the last thing about that is that in New York especially, right, what's one of the first things that people say when they go to New York City? It's, oh, I want to see a Broadway show. New York, Juilliard is there, the Metropolitan Opera is there, Alvin Ailey is there, the birthplace of hip-hop is in New York City. New York City is one of the, if not the most important cultural center in the United States. People come from all over the world to see and to be in shows there. And even now, the stupid union is screaming about funding for the arts, and they scream about how much revenue the arts bring to the city, how much Broadway brings into the city. It's woven in. Broadway, the performing arts are woven into the cultural identity of the city. And yet these people said that the performing arts are not essential. And that just blew my mind. It blew my mind because if they had any understanding of economics and the sort of interconnected systems and how everything works together, they would not have said, more people would have stood up and said, no, we can't shut down. And how are you going to allow the state? Now, these are the same people, by the way, who said, hashtag resistance, 4 years of we're worried about Trumpian fascism. And yet then the state comes in and they just totally abdicate all of their power to the state. And at a time where people were stressed out, they were afraid. This is what we provide. The service we provide as performing artists to the community is this sort of spiritual nourishment. And we can allow them to escape the troubles of the world for just a couple of hours and bring them some kind of joy and delight, bring them some kind of catharsis so they can kind of exercise their own demons. And the fact that they forgot all about that just really, really, really blew me away. And that's why I say there's no recovery from that when you have a collective which is so utterly disconnected from its function and its purpose in society.
I remember I asked you the first time you were on, was there any part of you that thought, well, look, you win. You win. This is what I trained my whole life for. This is where my heart is. So you win. I'll just do it and just be done with it. And, you gave me a really heartfelt answer, but part of the answer involved the people you would go back to working with. And I don't think I can work with people like this anymore. I don't think I can interact with somebody who thinks this way or who would look the other way as I'm being imposed upon like this or be part of the crowd condemning me or be silent as I'm enduring all this. This holds no appeal to me anymore. And yeah, it's pretty hard to come back from that. And especially to see the least courageous people on earth insufferably congratulating themselves on their courage.
Yeah, no, they made sacrifices. To this day, just yesterday, I'm not on Facebook very often, but I checked it out for about 2 seconds and there was this one actor who in the before times, I really adored him. And, he's doing a concert at a major venue in the city right now. And he posted an article that praised him. And, he thanked that particular outlet. And I just had to unfollow him because, for one, I can't watch anything that's made after 2020. But now when I see people posting about the work that they're doing now, that they still get to be allowed to do now, I am filled with this, I don't know if it's irrational, but it's not quite something I felt before. Like I saw that posting and I was filled with there was just this gnarled, hot, just rage in the pit of my stomach that I didn't even expect. I just saw it and I see these people and I see people who just complied with just one of the worst crimes of the century. I mean, it's only we're only 24 years into it, but I see people who went along with it. I see people who decided that I should be a second-class citizen. The term I use is niggerized. They niggerized people, you know, and then it's funny because then they say, well, you could choose, you know, you could, that's not a really good analogy because you can choose, you can't choose your race or whatever. So I'm like, well, so what you're really saying is I could have chosen whether or not I wanted to be niggerized by you people, you know, whether or not I got this vaccine or not. And it boggles my mind because, you know, what I hear now from my spies who are still on the inside is that the magic is kind of gone. There's a weird vibe in the air and people are just trying to move on. And even still, they're still doing some of this stuff. I had a friend text me just last night that a theater she's working at, they tried to impose mask mandates at the reception for the actors. So they're still doing this stuff. They're still testing. They're still calling out of shows because of what's essentially a cold. We all know this. So I'm like, how do you bounce back from that? And the fact that these people completely normalized a two-tiered society and they had no issue with it. I don't know how long it's going to take me to get past that, but it hasn't happened yet.
Folks, I've got a really terrific new sponsor, Federated Computer, and I want to thank them. If you're tired of being under the thumb of big tech, you don't particularly like the way they're acting, well, then maybe the next step is to stop using their tools. But, oh, they're free, people say. Yeah, but so is the gruel you get in prison. That's the way I look at it. It's free because, well, they're harvesting your data and they're manipulating you, but that doesn't have to be. Federated Computer doesn't do that. They offer a full replacement for Google, Microsoft Office 365, Slack, Zoom, and more. All these services you use. And it's for people who care about privacy and who also prefer not to be treated like cattle. Everything's encrypted end-to-end, fully backed up daily. We're talking private email, file storage, team chat, WordPress hosting, CRM, help desk, email marketing tools, and more, all bundled up into one easy monthly subscription. You get unlimited users without your price going up, great customer support from real human beings. It's all powered by open source software, so you can take your data wherever and whenever you like. So visit www.federated.computer/woods today for your free 30-day trial. So how about that? A company that thinks its job is to, you know, provide you with services instead of spying on you or shutting you up or manipulating you. So take your first step towards digital freedom. Visit www.federated.computer/woods today for your free 30-day trial. Can we talk for a minute about, I don't expect you to have like super technical details about it, but The Phantom of the Opera was the longest running, I think, Broadway production ever, 35 years, and it closed, I think, not due to natural causes.
There were articles that came out, I mean, the LA Times reported on it, I believe the Washington Post did as well, where after they reopened in late 2022, the theaters reopened, one third of the audience had not returned. There were other experts that predicted that by this spring or summer, that the industry would contract by about 50%. There are theaters around the country that are truncating their seasons, if not closing outright. Meanwhile, I mean, Taylor Swift is, you know, just selling out everywhere and paying massively big bonuses, and live music is thriving. The UFC is thriving. I was just at an NBA game just last night. I watched the Warriors take on the Atlanta Hawks. It was such an exciting atmosphere to be just in that arena. So, I mean, sports are doing great. It's just this one thing. People aren't going to it. And part of it is that they scare their own most loyal patrons. I mean, you know, yeah. COVIDianism is a specifically Democrat sickness, or I call them the bourgeoisie. It's a specifically
Democrat
sickness. Oh,
that's a brilliant word.
It's not mine. It was, a guy named Randall Bach, I believe his name was, I spoke to. I said, yeah, I call him the blue bourgeoisie. And he goes, the bourgeoisie. And I was like, I'm stealing that. He's like, go for it. The bourgeoisie has, it's a self-immolation. And, you know, all these mandates, these mask mandates, it didn't stop shows from closing. I mean, Aladdin was another show that kind of was a casualty for a little bit. Hugh Jackman was doing a show and he was calling out, you know, because there were outbreaks in the company, or he would test positive. So, you know, there were all these measures. I mean, apparently, you know, there was a point where they couldn't even keep enough understudies on hand, on deck, because of all the call-outs. Not to mention the costs to the producers of, you know, paying actors while they're out, still, you know, paying them while they're out, paying for all this testing and everything. I mean, it's just bonkers. It's complete bonkers. But it's because whatever it is in the blue bubble, you know, it's just, it's they're in it. And no matter what economic damage happens, I mean, that's the other thing too, Tom, is that they're so resigned to it all. That's the big thing as well. They're just like, well, I guess that's how it is. You know, this show closed and I don't know what to do about it. Or it's not, well, gosh, if people had taken this thing seriously from the beginning, then, you know, we wouldn't be here where we are today. And they just don't get it, Tom. They just do not get it. And they never will. They never will.
Yeah. I mean, I just wrote a book on this whole thing. You know, the data is entirely on our side. Like the whole, if only we had done X or Y. What the data shows, it just doesn't matter what you do. You know, it just apparently just does not matter. Otherwise, how come Florida did better on all-cause mortality than California? You know,
right? I mean, these people who, again, they hashtag resistance and dictatorship, yada, yada, yada. They somehow thought that the government could control the spread of a respiratory virus. You know, I'm reading Václav Havel's The Power of the Powerless right now. And one of the things that he really highlights, I think it's really insightful, is that, you know, these sort of totalitarian regimes, it's not necessarily about state power or top-down power. It's that it lives, the totalitarianism lives within the individuals that are victims of that system, and they perpetuate it themselves. And on top of that, these systems, they go against the aims of life and of nature. I mean, nature itself is diverse. It's always changing. It's harmonious. It's chaotic. It's all these things. It's beautiful in a sense. And yet, the aims of life are in direct contradiction to the aims of whatever this regime is. You know, and the bridge between the two, the reality and nature and the pseudo-reality that they live in is this ideology. And ideology is the main problem. They're victims of it and they can't see anything. And the ideology convinced them that they had to stay in their houses and not do anything and not see anybody for years on end until this magic so-called vaccine came out that would save the world. And their masks would be magic virus shields and they could do everything possible to avoid it as long as, you know, we did all the right things. And it just hasn't panned out and they can't accept that it hasn't panned out for them. It's so bizarre.
I want to say one other thing about Phantom of the Opera. I think one of the things that affected that was the ridiculous policy of the U.S. government of requiring the shots to enter the country. Because my guess is if you have a show that's running that long, that cannot be sustained entirely without feeder traffic from international tourism. I would guess that's got to at least be part of it. And you take that away, and you've terrified a big chunk of your domestic audience, that's a toxic combination.
Again, that's a huge thing, what I was saying before. People come from all over the world to see shows in New York City. And, you know, after 4 years of just vitriolic anti-Trumpism, followed by 3 more years of vitriolic COVIDianism, it's just, I'm not even particularly smart, you know what I mean? But it was obvious what the outcome was going to be. You've already alienated so much of your domestic audience via your politics, and then you have these policies, and then you have these other barriers for other people from outside the country to come in and see your show. I mean, you know, and what they'll say in response is that if you raise any kind of what sound like economic concerns, they'll say, well, you're just putting profits over people. Like they don't even know what an economy is. But then these are the same people who turned around and said, you know, oh, Pfizer, Moderna, come on, shoot me up. You know, it doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense.
No. But you know, what's interesting to me is that play that I saw you in, the play that goes wrong, what's interesting about it is that it is completely apolitical. It is not woke at all. It is just a couple of hours of top-notch entertainment. And one of the actors even told me that and said that that was actually one of the things he took pride in, that no matter what your thinking is, no matter where you're coming from, you can put that all aside and just enjoy the theater for a couple of hours. You know, if only more people thought that way.
You know, there's a great essay by, first of all, yeah, it's completely correct. It's one of the reasons I love the show so much is because for 2 hours, literally from the point you walk into the theater, the show begins to work on you.
Yeah.
And you've never heard an audience laugh like that.
I mean, never.
I've never heard that
never.
Before. People
yep.
crying, wheezing, just dying from laughter. Just a brilliant, I'd be on stage sometimes just watching it. And I'd just be like, damn, this is funny. This is just hilarious. Like it just never got old.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm not laughing. I'm just watching it. And also my cast was just, they were so great. I mean, and we got better. I think we were better than the original British cast, to be honest with you. And people told us the same thing. And J.J. Abrams, one of the co-producers, was like, yeah, this functions on a different level than the original cast, you know, which was really great, really great praise. But just a brilliant work that was completely apolitical. As a matter of fact, at one point, and I was injured by this point, so I was kind of, I had to sit out. But when the Parkland shootings happened, the cast got together and they got this shot where they were like, we stand with Parkland. And I just, if I were there, I would have said, you know, guys, don't do that. Like, it's one thing if you, as a cast, say, you know, we, the cast of this show, stand with, you know, these kids. That's one thing. But to be like backstage and in costume, taking pictures and say, you know, this show stands with, like, that's not part of the brand of the show. You know, that's not what it's about. Oh, shoot, I forgot where I was going to say before I got off on that tangent. I was really excited by it. Oh, yes, I remember. There's a great essay back in late 1945 by this Marxist named Isidore Snyder. He was writing in New Masses magazine, a Marxist publication, and he was talking about this idea of escapism and how it came to be seen as a dirty word among these Marxist artists. And it's interesting because even back then, he had the depth of understanding and the nuance to understand that, no, you know, sure, we understand that just because something doesn't have social utility doesn't mean that it has no value as art. And the trap that a lot of his colleagues fell into, which he was criticizing, was that they would completely dismiss the human need for, you know, relaxation and satisfaction and joy. It's like, guys, not every piece of art has to be infused with the issues of the day. Like, it's really okay to just sit back and enjoy a couple of hours of fluff or popcorn theater or popcorn cinema or whatever. Like, that's an essential part of life. And when you have these sort of left-wing ideologies, which are so, so hell-bent on presenting the audience with the issues, first of all, it becomes very stale and it limits the writing. But also, if you write something for that political moment, it becomes irrelevant as soon as a new issue comes in. So it was so fascinating to see these authors nearly 80 years ago writing about the same things that we're dealing with today, but they had more intelligence about the issue than I think a lot of our intelligentsia has today.
Let's thank our sponsor, Monetary Metals, but I hope you have a handkerchief because this is a tearjerker, my friends. It's a sad story. You'll recall from years and years ago on the Tom Woods Show, we used to encounter the recurring character of Bad Luck Ichabod. But I bet you didn't know Bad Luck Ichabod was a gold holder. Yes, indeed. He was smart enough to know he should own some gold. But that, I'm sorry to say, my friends, that's where his smartness ended. That's where it ended, because his gold just sat there and sat there. Meanwhile, old Woods here was smart enough not just to buy gold, but also to open an account with Monetary Metals. So old Woods here earns interest on his gold, paid in gold. All right, I'm done referring to myself in the third person. What's the advantage of letting your gold just sit there, as Bad Luck Ichabod does, as he looks enviously upon me because I'm earning up to 5% in the Monetary Metals gold leasing program? Or you could be earning double-digit returns in their gold bonds if you're an accredited investor. It really is true. I've put my money, my gold, where my mouth is, and I've opened an account with Monetary Metals. I've had it for about 2 years now. Well, it's time for you to do the same. Don't be Bad Luck Ichabod. Join me and our old friend Jeff Deist as we lead an honest money revolution that starts by opening an account at Monetary Metals today. Go to monetary-metals.com/woods to learn more. That's monetary-metals.com/woods. I know this is a little bit inside baseball, so I promise I'll keep this part brief, but the guy who played the role you played in the play that goes wrong before you in the original cast was Henry Lewis. Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
Yeah, they worked with us on the show a lot.
Okay, as you were becoming the first American cast. Because, of course, he has a different, well, let's just say body type from you, yeah, and a somewhat different style. And so I had kind of gotten used to that cast. And so I'll be honest with you, when I sat, I didn't know it was a new cast. And I was sitting in the audience ready to go, and you guys came out, I was kind of, you know, a little bit upset. Like, what? Who are these interlopers? But then by the end of the show, I thought, oh my gosh, I am sorry I doubted these people. I mean, it was just so, so great. You both brought a different kind of energy to that crazy character, and it worked for both of you guys just so, so well. But I don't want to stay on a topic that is obscure to, let's say, to most viewers. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about a project you're kicking around and want to get started on in earnest very soon that will return you to where you rightfully belong.
Yeah. So I guess I'll go back a little bit. So when I was in my last year at conservatory at NYU, we had this program, I guess I would call it, called Free Play. And Free Play was where the students could, I guess you could call it the equivalent of a thesis a little bit. So in free play, you could pretty much do whatever you want. So I had a classmate who wrote a full-on musical. Other people wrote full-on plays. And I wrote this solo show that was very based in hip-hop and autobiographical. I was playing all these different characters from, you know, Americans to Germans to my own mom and, you know, these all these crazy characters. And that show actually netted me my first agent before I even graduated from school. So people have always been asking me, you know, are you going to make another show? Like, when's the next one coming along? And I said, well, I hear you, but, you know, I don't really feel like I have anything to say right now. So then years and years later, this wonderful actor named Lawrence Fishburne did this play called Thurgood, which I think Spike Lee taped it or filmed it for HBO. But it was this one-man show where Lawrence played Thurgood Marshall. And, you know, I thought it was very interesting. And it also reminded me of another play called Paul Robeson, or I think it was just Robeson, and James Earl Jones inhabited that part. So these great solo plays by these prominent Black American figures have been produced before. But I said, you know, it's really interesting because there's someone who I think is a titanic figure in America, this Black American figure, but no one seems to know about him. He's always ignored. He's always kind of cutting through all the nonsense, but he deserves to be, I think he deserves a show of his own, a one-person show of his own. And I just had this idea for the longest time to say, you know, what if Thomas Sowell was the subject of one of these shows? And that sort of has been kicking around in my mind for the longest time. And what's great is that, you know, we not only have his 45 plus books, we not only have hours and hours of his lectures and interviews and thousands of columns. So we have this huge, huge canon from which to draw where you can build something. And I said, you know, what if there is a way to build some kind of show out of his own words and tell his story? So now I'm at the point where I said, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm going to take on the biggest challenge of my career. I'm going to pour my 20 years of experience and training and chops into building a solo play about Thomas Sowell. And so that's the idea right now. Very exciting, very scary, but that's always the best reason to do something is when you're afraid of it.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Well, I've run this by a few people who, you know, are in various nonprofits and whatever in our world broadly conceived. And they are all just going berserk with enthusiasm for the idea of this project. So as you prepare to do this, obviously, as you say, there's a mountain of stuff. You're not going to have any shortage of material. There's a huge mountain of stuff out there that you'd want to go through a good chunk of it and absorb and get a lot of details and stuff and work it into a play. And that's a big undertaking. So you have started a crowdfunding page, which I am urging people to go contribute to. I'm going to contribute to it. I'm not going to ask people to do something that I myself wouldn't do. And it's easy to remember the link. It's soulplay.com. So that's S-O-W-E-L-L, soulplay.com. Not only do you know this is going to be fantastic, needs to be done, is absolutely countercultural in the best possible ways, but it also involves taking a guy who has suffered absurdly unjustly and putting him to work on a project he is absolutely going to crush. There is every reason to support this. So, you know, I say this just because I want to help the guy. Like, I don't, like, I'm not getting any kickback for this. If I did, I'd kick it right back to you, Clifton.
I do appreciate that. And, you know, it's very exciting for multiple reasons. One, there is a growing movement of, you know, I call heterodox artists who are really fed up with the way things are going. So not all of the, you know, performing arts are full of crazy ideologues. We're looking for new avenues in which to present our work. We're looking for new ways that we can share what we do with the world. I think there's such a huge, huge untapped audience that's outside of the confines of LA and New York that just wants to be served with just life-changing art. And it's a massive and noble undertaking, but I really think, you know, and whenever I post stuff online with stuff that I've done before, it's really funny because people will say things like, I followed you for your political takes, but I had no idea you could do all of that. Like, holy crap, like, do, you know, show me more of this. So, you know, and it says to me, this is from Shakespeare to musical theater. And it says to me that people want to be entertained by people who don't hate them. And on top of all of that, I'm very excited by it just because it's not only about soul, it's also about what he means to the broader zeitgeist at large. You know what I mean? So like this show would never get made. A show like this would never get made in the current system. And I think it has broad appeal outside the system. Whenever I talk about this particular or this idea or this concept, people go absolutely bananas for it. They want to see it. They love the idea of it. And they want to see something like that. And I'm thinking to myself, well, why not just, I'm an artist learning my business chops. You know, why not solve this pain point of people who are like, you know, underserved,
right,
with something that they want to see, but also from someone who's such a titanic figure and who cuts across so many lines in terms of like, what is conventional wisdom? What are our received opinions? What do we understand about the world? I mean, his writing and his scope, his breadth of work, it spans far beyond economics. It deals with philosophy and the human condition and all these other things. And so, you know, it will take a lot of immersion and lots of research, but, you know, and I want to know I'm still learning what my point of view is about it, but there has to be a show in there that you can find a way to weave together a satisfying narrative. And also it's just fun for an audience to watch someone transform into somebody else. So, and it's fun for me too, as well.
Oh, absolutely. And he's so remarkable on so many levels. Man, I've been reading him since I was in high school. And I remember he had, I don't know how many kids he has. I don't know his biography very well, but he has at least one child. So at least one of his children was a slow talker, was slow to talk. He was a late talking children is what it's called. And so Sowell wrote a book called Late Talking Children, because he had one. So he decided to learn everything he possibly could. And then I guess he decided, well, I've got all this knowledge, I'll write a book on it. I mean, it's a very small sliver of the human population that acquires a body of knowledge and thinks, you know, the obvious solution here is for me to write a book. So he just went ahead and did that. So he's impressive on so many levels. He's also a courageous person, all this stuff. And also he changed his mind. You know, he started off as a left winger at the beginning of his career. So, and again, that's very, very rare to see somebody who has a genuine, sincere change of mind. By the way, let me give a quick example, somewhat similar. I have a friend named Eric July, and he started a comic book universe called Ripaverse, and it was his own thing, and they all said it couldn't be done kind of thing. And now he's wildly successful with it. And one of the things about it is it's not woke, but he says that's not the main thing about it. I mean, yeah, it's not woke, but the main reason I did it was that I felt like Marvel and DC had lost some of their integrity with the way some of their storylines were going and all that. And I wanted to have a clean slate with that. But it is non-woke, but that's not his main selling point. But all the same, that did bring in a lot of people to support him who were not typically comic book readers, who just, they wanted to support Eric July and what he was doing. And so his critics would say, oh, look at how many of his customers aren't comic book readers, as if that was a bad thing. He's expanding the universe and they're acting like this is wrong.
It's the ideology, you know, they have to find some way to hate this person. And, you know, and you've been skimping on details. I mean, his campaigns have brought in, they've been multi-million dollar campaigns. And just to go back a little bit, you know, I think one of the great things about that story, which it's wonderfully ironic, right? That one of the best talkers of all time had a child, who, you know, was a late talker.
Yeah.
And to me, it gives the character of Thomas Sowell a depth and a dimension and a humanity, because, you know, what father isn't going to care for their child? So it's these kinds of things that you can bring to these kind of universal human themes that you can highlight. And, you know, his time in the military, his time as a photographer, you know, I love the fact that he stuck with under Milton Friedman, for God's sakes, and still didn't change his mind until he went to the government. So it's all these kinds of things on his journey that make it so interesting. And it makes me wonder, you know, what are the sort of Joseph Campbell kind of archetypes you can bring to the stage? Like, what are these sort of deep Jungian symbology that you can sort of bring to the fore? Because I think Eric has the right idea in terms of, you know, you don't want the response to quote unquote wokeness to be anti-woke, because that's just as ideologically driven and limited in that way as the woke arts, woke stuff is. All you need to do is do great work focused on universal human themes with a satisfying dramatic arc. And that's all it has to be in order to be successful, so to speak. Now, success doesn't have to mean monetary success. It could just mean like it's just a successful piece of art, and that it, you know, it delineates this character or it tells a satisfying narrative. And so that's my philosophy as well, is that, you know, I don't want to lean towards or target a libertarian audience or a conservative audience or whatever. I want to tell a story about this human being, this extraordinary human being, and his different shades of life. And what's great about the kind of work that I do, I'm very skilled at what's called character work. So, you can always shift a character by, you know, maybe you just place his voice up in the nasal hand, you know, nasally, or maybe place the voice down here a little bit, you know, slow down a little bit, give him a little bit of an accent, you know what I'm saying? So there's all kinds of ways you can go. So maybe Jesse Jackson might turn up in the play. Maybe Malcolm X might turn up in the play. Maybe MLK might turn up in the play. So it's not just about soul. It's about the period that he came up in and how his views contrasted with other prominent views of the time. So there's so many ways you can go with it, which I think will be very, very exciting for an audience to see.
So folks, we're all going to pitch into this, soulplay.com. When you're done listening to this, you're going to click on the link in the description or on show notes page, tomwoods.com/2450, soulplay.com. Do what you can. I'm going to do what I can and spread this around. This episode, that link, spread it around. All the influencers we know need to be tweeting this out. And I'm going to call in some favors and get them to tweet this out, see how many people we can reach. Maybe we can get Elon Musk to retweet it. You know, who knows? Whatever we need to do, whatever we can do, I think we ought to do. Because just listening to this tantalizing overview of what this play could be, I think should suffice to suggest to you how great it's likely to end up. So I definitely want to be a part of it. I hope you all will too. So soulplay.com. Do you have any final words for us, Clifton, as we wrap up today?
Not much. You know, just thank you, Tom, for all your support. And everyone watching, you know, thank you as well for going to soulplay.com and supporting this wonderful work. You know, I can't wait to, it's been living in my head for a long time. I want to get it, you know, I want to get it out onto the page and then the stage. And, you know, I just need time to immerse myself in the subject and really develop a script in only the way that an actor like myself can do. So I hope we can get your support and thank you in advance. If we get it.
Well, thank you, Clifton, very much for the conversation today, as always. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.